Hello. Before we get started, this is another one of my replay episodes before we go back to new episodes while I take a break. So I want to talk about this episode in particular with Victoria Kirst. I recorded this episode in a time when I was still figuring out where I wanted to go in my career. Of course, this is always something I'll be figuring out, and I think most people are always figuring out. But there's one particular part in this episode where Victoria talks about why we need technical leaders. At the time, I was debating on whether I wanted to stay a developer or take on a tech lead role. And that conversation led me to taking on the tech lead role, which really changed my outlook of the tech industry and also made me really excited about being a leader in tech. If you are a developer who is maybe interested in doing leadership things, or you maybe don't enjoy coding as much, but you love all the other aspects of the tech industry, or maybe you're not even a developer and you just want to learn more about leadership and how leadership in tech works, this is a great episode to dig into, and I'm really excited to share this. I typically refer to this episode as my all-time favorite episode. At this point, we've had so many episodes that I'm not sure anymore because there's so many good ones. But this one is a great one to dig into if you're listening for the first time or you haven't heard this one yet. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy. And now to the episode. You're listening to Blossoming Technologist, a podcast for young professionals in tech, discovering skills, careers, and tips for being in the tech industry. I'm your host, Marissa, and every week I interview a young professional to share their story on getting into the tech industry, what they currently do, and actionable advice for you navigating your own way. I'm so excited to have you here. Before we get started, I want to let you know about an awesome opportunity to teach computer science. Stanford University is running their second iteration of Code in Place, a five-week free program to teach people how to code from all over the world. If you have computer science experience and love to teach, I highly recommend this opportunity. I participated last year and it reinvigorated my love for computer science. The Call for Teachers website is linked in the show notes and the application is due March 25th. Feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions. Now, let's talk about today's episode. Today, we're joined by Victoria Kirst, an incoming software engineer at The Browser Company, former software engineer at Google for 8 years, former lecturer at Stanford, and most recently, the director of platform and then VP of engineering at a startup, Glitch. This is such an incredible conversation about software engineering, education, shaping your career, and the differences between working at a startup and at a big company. We dive into Victoria's personal career journey, lessons learned, and advice for you, and there are plenty of computer analogies. Without further ado, let's jump in. Victoria, thank you so much for being here. I'm excited to have you on the show. And I wanted to jump into what first got you interested in the tech industry.
Yeah, so my journey started early-ish. I'm of the age where the internet was like just emerging when I was like a young teenager. And so initially I was just like really fascinated by the internet. So at the time, dial-up was our only option. And my family both did not want to pay for dial-up and didn't want to tie up like the phone lines. So it was a big deal. It was like, you know, you're on the internet, you can choose the internet or your phone. And so they're like, the only way we're allowing you to use the internet is to like get up really early in the morning. So little Victoria would get up at like 4 a.m. so that I can browse the internet. And what was I looking up? I was looking up cute pictures. I was looking up anime things, like anime fan sites. Like, I was a stan before stan was a concept. So it was just like, ew, I love this anime. So I was kind of aware of like websites. And then I was again playing on the computer and I found these programs. It was like Microsoft Word or Front Page, or like I would like go through the Office suite and I realized in some of the widgets, there'd be stuff for web page. And I was like, oh, can I make my own web page? So I sort of fiddled around with that. I didn't really do coding per se. It was just like, okay, like let me make my pretend web page, and then sort of like stumbled into, I can like, oh, I guess I can upload this to the internet. Anyway, so what's kind of interesting, though, is despite this, due to the, you know, stereotype of coding, I still didn't think it was for me. I took a programming class in high school. I got a really good grade, but I hated it. And it, like, again, in retrospect, I can tell, oh, it was the teacher, it was the environment. But I just thought, oh, I am bad at it. I'm bad at this. Despite me being like little internet, like I'm going to get up at 4 a.m. to like go on the internet. I thought I was bad at it. And then my mom was encouraging me like, hey, you're interested in computers and things. Why don't you give it another try? So I took a CS class in college, literally just to prove to my mom and to myself, I don't like this. I told you I don't like this. And then I ended up really liking it. But even then I was like very skeptical, like, maybe I don't like it enough. Maybe I'm not good enough. Like just serious imposter syndrome. And so, again, I think it took me probably until a year into my career where I was like, okay, fully graduated. I am now a year in my career. Okay, now I think I am interested in the tech industry.
Yeah. So when you realized in college that like this is something that you do like, did you like change your major to computer science and then pursue that?
Yeah. So actually, like maybe a through line and like sort of my career advice is like, in general, how I've made decisions are either if I know what I want to do, I do that. If I don't know what I want to do, but I know like the question to ask, I pursue that. And then if I have no idea, I go with what I call a safe default. So like, just like, okay, well, this is just a safe answer. I went to University of Washington and you can declare your major when you enter. And so I actually just declared my major computer science because I was like, I could change it later. Like I was going to go with that, but then change it later. So I ended up going with it because it was also a competitive major. And so like, if I could get in, anyway, I was gaming the system. And then I was fully expecting to be like, whatever, I'm going to change my major away from CS. And then I was like, dang it. I became a CS major.
I actually like this.
Yeah, I was like, wait, oh, yeah. But yeah, like it's part of why I'm really passionate about education and especially one's intro experience, because my entire career was changed because of poor intro experience and a really good intro experience. So yeah, it also sort of frames some of the decisions I've made in my career as well.
Yeah. Oh, that makes so much sense. I know you're really passionate about education and helping others learn. And so it's cool to hear that that really stems from like how you got into the tech industry and just wanting to make that better for other people. And that's how I feel too. Like, that's why I made this podcast, because I want people to be able to like figure out where they want to be in the tech industry. Because I feel like I didn't know. I'm still figuring it out, you know?
Same.
And there's just so many options. Yes.
Yeah.
So now you are a software engineer and you've been a software engineer for 11 years. So what do you love about software engineering?
I think there's actually like three qualities about software engineering that I love. And they are creativity, imperfection, and optimism. So what do I mean by that? So again, when I was like little, I both liked the internet and I like creating things. One of the most exciting things to me as a child was a blank sheet of paper. I'd be like, whoa, so many possibilities. You know, it's just like, oh my God. And so like, I love blank notebooks, but I would always be like, well, but that first stroke is really hard. You know, it's like, ah, no, I ruined my blank sheet of paper. I made a decision. So what I loved about programming, it's sort of like the four-dimensional, most powerful blank sheet of paper you can imagine, and you can undo. So it's like, not only can you draw a picture, you can create basically whatever you want. Plus, you can undo, and you have history, and you have, you know, like so much to build upon. So it's like the creativity and the amount of creative expression you can have, I think, with software engineering is really inspiring. And then again, there are two other parts that I think are even more, why does it resonate with me so much? So I think this is under talked about, but programming is also inherently imperfect. What I mean by that is like, you can even study sort of lower level systems and things and see how does a computer work? How does like, everything's an approximation all the way down to the wire. It's all approximations. Like there's literally no way to create truly random algorithms, for instance, but we found a way to do it good enough. And so this idea of like, you know, we are essentially trying to do the impossible, and not able, like knowing in the face of like knowing it is impossible to achieve randomness, to still be like, I don't care, I'm going to get as close as I can to the, like, to like sort of redefine what a victory is and like what achievement is, like that's super inspiring to me. And then that sort of like goes into the third point of like optimism. I also think like that's very optimistic, right? Of like, even in the face of something that's literally impossible, finding solutions, like this idea of like, you're presented with a problem and it's not like, well, the end. It's like the entire premise of software engineering is like problem, solution, like finding solutions. So all three of those are just very, very much resonate with me on a like very human level. And so those are the things I'm passionate about when it comes to software engineering.
I've never thought about the imperfection thing. And I love your example of like randomness and like, we just keep trying to get it, but we know it's never going to be achieved right, because it's impossible.
Yeah. And I think of another example I use is like Mario. Think about the first ever Mario game and like, it's like super pixelated. And then like Mario now is like, whoa, it's like really, really realistic. But what I love is that it's not like the first Mario is a bad game. It's actually a joyful game on its own. Like, I love the idea of like, it's all victories, you know, it's like, it's all different interpretations. Again, that's where it comes, like the imperfection and optimism, like combined, is like just a really compelling thing. And the space is like infinite and vast. It's just like, oh my God, how can you not love software engineering, is my bias, very biased take on it.
And the creativity, like you mentioned, everyone who's a software engineer has these different ideas and different motives and different ways of implementing things that like, you're never going to get the same exact thing twice. There's always going to be different apps and different websites and this whole world.
I know. And it's also, again, why I'm like passionate of like, okay, we got to democratize technology. We got to bring more people into this, because I really think if it's like an equal playing field, as equal as we can get, and like really giving people this power, it's kind of hard to imagine not in some way finding a way to like really enjoy it or be able to utilize it and like really grow and take advantage of it.
With software engineering being such a cool field, like we're both in it, we both know that it's awesome. What do you think stops people from getting involved in it?
There are a lot of things that can do it. You actually get introduced to programming very late in your education. Like, so imagine, for instance, as a comparison to math or even biology or something, like a lot of times you get introduced to these things very slowly over time, so that you can, one, just like have it be really integrated as a comprehensive like education. And then two, genuinely have the opportunity to decide if this is something you like or not. Because yes, there are some folks where they're going to like look at programming or software engineering or tech and like truly not be interested in it. But I just don't think that that's by any like meaningful way the majority reason. Again, I truly thought in my intro class that I didn't like this thing, but it was actually because all the circumstances around it rather than the subject itself, versus like, had that been one computer science class out of 12 that I've taken in my entire education, I probably would have, you know, just the numbers would have worked out better. Like, oh, actually, with a lot more time, oh, actually, I didn't like the teacher. Like, I think that's one of the things. And yeah, like, I also think, again, because like, it's such a short time frame, it's like, the opportunities to learn it are kind of like, okay, well, either do it in college or you know, I think boot camps are wonderful. But at the same time, they're a big decision. Like, are you going to quit your job to like go into a different career? It's like, you have to make these huge decisions to even figure out, do I like this? So again, I think if we could integrate it in the like K-12 education, make it more of a like part of a foundational education for someone to then choose, like, okay, again, in the same way that you can kind of figure out with math of like, either like, yay, calculus, or no. I think giving people more of an opportunity to make that decision means pushing it more early in the curriculum.
I think hopefully some schools are integrating it more into education. I've heard that recently. I've had a lot of talks recently with people like early career, maybe in college, where they're like, I just don't want to sit behind a computer all day. And it's like, well, like, yes, that is a reality sometimes, but there's so much more than that. And we just know that stereotype, and then people don't choose it.
I know. And what's wild is it's not only okay to not be that stereotype. Those are the folks who become principal engineers or CTO or VP of engineering, because it's like all of it's about systems. It's more systems than programming per se. Like programming is one of the lowest, like in terms of a stack, lowest level systems when it comes to like building a company, building a product, you know, building an eng org. The higher level stacks end up being people. And so if you're really great at thinking about how does this group of people function, that's engineering. Like, that's like, those are the skills, like combined with like some technical skills. Again, oh, okay. So, you know, you like, you don't want to be behind a computer all the time. You really like talking with people. What that means is, so rather than only being limited to software engineer, you can be literally any position, like the highest level in the company. It doesn't limit you. It like means that you can do anything you want.
Oh, that's awesome to hear, because I feel like I felt that way in college. And so I'm sure there are others who feel that way and then can maybe try out software engineering and realize that in the future they can move up to those levels.
Yeah. Yeah. And oh my God. and it's badly needed also. And like, and yeah, like they're the most awesome engineer, programmer, leader type, very much something you should feel encouraged to pursue.
Okay, so I kind of want to switch gears a little bit into choosing and shaping your career, because I know that you've had a bunch of different experiences from working at Google for 8 years to lecturing at Stanford to working at a startup for 2 years. So take a step back, first of all, and want to talk about like, how do you define a career?
It's interesting because it's like we talk a lot about career paths, opportunities, you know, what's good for your career or bad. So I think I'll define it and then I'll also like sort of say a caveat. So I think a career is very simple in some ways, where it's like your working life and how you progress through your working life. However, what your career ends up being and like what it means to you depends on two very personal things, which are your basic survival needs and your life journey and your life goals. So I think if you are trying to shape your career, if you're trying to figure out your career, what the shape of that looks like depends on, again, your basic survival needs and also your life goals. So for instance, I can imagine, you know, you can totally have some life goals where your career and your occupation is very minimized. It's like, it's maybe something that is really a means for money or support or survival. And it's kind of like, okay, this is going to support me in doing something that I feel really fulfilled in. That's an option. Or your career and your occupation might be very intertwined with your life goals of like, I really want to, you know, I care a lot about education or something. And therefore I'm going to choose a career path to work in education and make sure that what I'm doing in my day-to-day job is really related to that. And either path is valid. There are so many other paths that are also valid. But yeah, like I think where it gets tricky is just that like, in order to figure out your career, you have to also kind of figure out your other very personal things, like what do you want to do with your life, which can be, which is why it can be very tricky to navigate.
So I guess like thinking back to when you graduated college, did you have a particular path you thought you were going to pursue? And then like, how did that change over time?
I had no path. Absolutely nothing. So again, I was very skeptical of whether this was right for me at all. I was very in my head about the whole thing. And so my goal from, you know, let's say high school through college, maybe before high school even, was just like, get a job, like get a stable job, yep. Right? Yep. Yeah. And so I was, again, sort of like, okay, I graduated college. I got a job at Google. Great. That's stable. Like good name, brand name, place to be. Okay. Let's see if I hate it. Like that was the first requirement. Do I hate my life being in this job? No, I enjoy it. Great. I am actually enjoying it. I feel like I'm, oh, surprise. I'm even good at it. This is all I could ask for. So that was like a year into my, you know, job at Google. Unfortunately, there is a lot more career than your first year. And so like after that, I had nothing planned at all because I was like, done. I have a job, right? And again, I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but like very soon, like around age 25, like right on the dot, I had a total quarter life crisis. But to answer your question, yeah, right after college, I was just intent on getting a job and I had when I say never thought about it, I never thought about what I would do beyond that. A lot of my career path has been trying to figure that out, actually.
And I think it's so funny because, like, I feel the same way. Like, I all through like high school, college, I'm like, cool, gonna get the job, got the job. And you're like, wait, what now?
It's not done. Like, I know. Like, I thought the end credits. No, crap, I'm at the beginning. No.
Yeah. And then you get into these careers and people are like, oh, yeah, like, you really need to own like your career path and figure out what you wanna do, figure out what your goals are. And no one's ever prepared you for that. And it's like, honestly, maybe that's something that needs to be taught in our education, to be like, yes, college is an end, but like, it's also a start to a much longer movie.
Yeah. Actually. Okay. So there's a quote that I love that if there is anyone listening that like knows me in person, they're going to roll their eyes because I talk about this quote all the time. So it's this woman writer named Ashley C. Ford. She also has a book out, so you should go pre-order it. Anyway, the quote goes like this. It's, I've never dreamed big enough. You know what happens when you're too scared to dream big, or when the circumstances of your life limit your imagination. By the time someone finally asks you what you want, you have no idea how to answer that question. You have to practice knowing what you want, just like you have to practice anything else. Can you describe your wildest dreams to someone else? Can you describe them to yourself? Even now, practice now. Why not? Anyway, I read that and I was just like, the reason why I keep repeating it is just like, it was so accurate to me. I was like, oh my God, I've never dreamed big enough. I've never, like, it can really affect particularly women, particularly underrepresented groups. Also folks who, you know, maybe their parents needed to just survive. The option of being able to define your career is a privilege, right? Like, the baseline is still survival. Like, are the bills getting paid? Are your basic needs met? If you're doing that, you know, that can be your full-time job. And so then to grow up in that environment, and again, like, from really, even from a place of good, where like your parents or adults around you are trying to support you and protect you and be like, okay, don't be lured by these silly, frivolous dreams of yours. Like, practical, like, survive. But what happens when you, again, have the privilege of, okay, you are surviving. Now what? And I think, again, especially if you're underrepresented or, you know, in other ways, like, also just the societal pressure of like, make yourself smaller. Don't dream too big. Like, I think it's something that I really had to spend a lot of time unlearning, and I'm still constantly unlearning even now.
Wow. That's an amazing quote. And it's just so true. It's like, once you have the basic needs for survival, you have this like existential crisis of, wait, like, what else am I doing in my life? Where is this going?
Yeah, totally. And I think I also, you know, especially again, if you're underrepresented or you came from like maybe underprivileged background or something, I know I actually felt very guilty. I was like, I'm so privileged to even be in this position where I'm like, wringing my hands over my career. Do I even deserve this? Like, I felt almost like guilty. And so again, that was when I was 25. I'm older now. So in case it's helpful, sort of what like got me past that point is, I think of a lot of things in terms of computer analogies. So I think of it like infrastructure. So like, I think the base layer, like the critical layer of the system is survival, right? And again, not a checkbox, not trivial, not guaranteed. Okay. But if you are, then I actually think it comes down to like, you know, three things. One, what does fulfill me? What makes me whole? What are my dreams? What do I want to do? Two, how am I making the world better? How am I adding a net positive to the world? And how am I causing harm? How am I, you know, reducing the amount of harm that I cause? What was helpful to me was to think of it in terms of this optimization problem of like, okay, again, baseline survival, but then I want to maximize the combination of fulfilling to me, making the world a better place, and minimizing harm. And so again, that's how I wish that it were taught, I suppose, growing up. So it didn't have to feel like, well, I have to either choose the smart, practical option of not of suppressing my dreams and like not thinking about fulfillment versus, you know, like, it's not an either or. I do think it's a multivariate constraints problem. But yeah, like all these things like are in balance, and it's not like an either or.
it makes a lot of sense. And I also really love that you explained everything in terms of technology and computers. Like, this just makes me so happy. You're such a teacher.
Yeah, you got me.
So I have one other question I really want to ask about careers. I know you have jumped between a couple different companies. So like, how do you know when it's time to switch jobs?
Yeah, let's just walk through my crises. What I had done, like, I think the first 4 years of my career was I was just kind of continuing like a treadmill of success or whatever. Like, folks were telling me, oh, you should get promoted. Okay, I guess I'll try to get promoted. Okay, you should lead a project. All right, I became a tech lead. And that was great. I don't regret that at all. I think that was good advice. I think I grew and learned a lot about what I was capable of. But at a certain point, I was around a bunch of wonderful, like, the most supportive people who were doing jobs I didn't want. The nicest, like, most welcoming people above me who are just like, oh my gosh, here's this cool big opportunity in a domain I didn't care about at all. So like, what happened was, like, you know, I went to Google, I got into Chrome, love Chrome. I really loved, I was working on the media team, working on like media engine things, really thought it was interesting, loved it. Enjoyed it a lot for 4 years, which is a long time. But the thought of like, oh crap, if I don't change anything, I'm just going to be a media person for, I could easily be a media person by accident, which again, if that was something that fulfilled me and like, that's a dream career for someone. So I have, you know, nothing against that. It just wasn't what I wanted. And at that point was like, okay, not only is this not what I want, oh crap, I don't even know what I want. So it then just became like, all right, let's even just try to figure out what do I want? And so like, in terms of like, when do you know to make a change? I think like, one is like, if you're unhappy, like that was a good sign of like, oh, I'm unhappy. And I think it's easier when it's like really clear, like, oh, this sounds awful. And it wasn't like that. I think it's hard when it's like, it's not that that's horrible. It just doesn't seem to be getting me closer to what I want. So I think that's also the moment to make a change. And it's okay if you're not sure what to what yet. So like at that point, I was just making guesses based on very little information. So I was living in Seattle. I was like, I'm here out of inertia. Like, I grew up in Washington State. I like some things about Seattle. I don't like other things. Okay, I'm gonna move out of the city. And then yeah, Chrome Media team, also inertia, right? Like, I enjoyed it, but this is the only thing I've ever worked on. So I changed those two things, moved to New York. I worked on Google Maps. It sort of started with that, of like really broad. And since I've had that sort of exercise of like, again, another tech analogy, it's like sort of trying something, do like a retrospective of like, okay, what worked, what didn't work, and like a really neutral one, you know, not like beating yourself up or anything, but just, okay, what did I like about this? What didn't I? And progressively making changes. Now, when I'm making moves in my career, it's much more precise. The move that I made from like Glitch to browser, I had a much clearer picture of like what I was looking for in my next role, because I've had all these different jumps, every jump where I've gotten a little bit closer to like understanding what it is that I'm looking for.
I'm almost thinking, not a tech analogy, but like a board game analogy. It's almost like you're playing a game of Battleship and you're trying to figure out where the hit is, and you're slowly like hitting the empty waters or whatever. And
yes.
Eventually like just knocking off one thing, like, oh, I didn't like this part. Oh, I did like this part. Let's narrow that down further. That's really cool and very helpful.
Yeah. And again, it does converge. It's like, you will get there, which can feel, again, when you're making that first move, it could just be like, oh my God, I'm moving across the country for, I don't know. It's like kind of a guess. I might hate it. But like, even if there are things that you really don't like about it, that's information. You know, you can learn from that and you could then be like, oh, okay. You'll help figure out like what you appreciate about different circumstances. So it's worked really well for me.
Yeah. So I kind of want to talk about what working at a big company is like versus working at a startup. So to kind of take a step back again at the beginning, we haven't really talked about startups at all on the podcast yet. So what makes a company a startup?
It's really unclear. So it's, I Googled it. It is very ill-defined. There's like an old TechCrunch article on this. So it can be super confusing because it's like the extremes are obvious. Like if you know, me and you decide to start a company tomorrow, a startup, right? That's a startup. And obviously Google is not a startup. Okay. What's in between? And so it can be super confusing. And like this TechCrunch article goes into it. Like, it's like, well, is it profitability? Is that when you're not a startup anymore? No, there are companies that are not startup, like Amazon, the article mentions, like Amazon was not profitable for a long time and still clearly not a startup. Okay. So like, what's the thing that makes it? Again, there are some goalposts, but like, I think when you're publicly trading, that like IPO, it seems like that's, people agree, okay, you've graduated from startup land at that point. And then, okay, but what if you're choosing, what if you're just a company that's choosing not to IPO because there's like drawbacks to that? So again, in this article, they have even very specific numbers of like $50 million in revenue runway. So like basically you can exist for the next 12 months with $50 million in revenue, 100 or more employees, and worth more than $500 million. So all that to say is it's really fuzzily defined. A better question, perhaps, than is it a startup or not, is how mature is the company? Because even within startups, really early stage startups are very different in terms of what working there would be like and also the risk than a more late stage startup. So that's why like trying to define it is like kind of hard. And you have to talk about things like revenue and stuff, because it's, revenue ends up being an indirect metric for a lot of things. Like, okay, if you're getting like on the order of like $50 million in revenue, probably, not necessarily, but probably, like your systems are a little bit more mature. You have probably figured out product market fit and that you have some amount, like you understand your business. All of those things have sort of effects on the maturity of the company. It's kind of like a sliding scale of maturity where earliest stage startup is the least mature version of a company. Big company is the most mature version. And at some point, startup on the sliders goes from like startup to small company. That point, there's not an agreement on. IPO is one of them, or you're making a lot of money is another one.
Okay. Very interesting. Well, I'm glad you at least are also confused about this, because it's something I'm a little bit confused on. And I also just want to clarify, in case people don't know, IPO means initial public offering. That's when a company is actually like able to be traded publicly and people can like buy stocks of the company. So one thing that I know about startups, I've never worked for a startup, but there's a lot of stereotypes behind it. Maybe you don't make a lot of money because it's a very new company, or maybe you work really long hours. So as someone who has worked for at least one startup, have you found these to be true?
Like many of the answers, it really depends on the startup. And so one thing I learned through being at a startup, the stage also matters a lot. For better or worse. To me, like Series A, Series B, pre-seed, all that was jargon that I was like, I don't know what it is, too bored to even look it up. So I'm just going to join this company without even looking into that, which I actually think, again, I don't think it was a mistake, but I didn't quite know what I was getting into because it was a pre-revenue Series A company, which just means if you think of the scale of like stability, that is much less stable because without changes, you are going to run out of money because you have an investment, you have a, you know, just big pile of money. You don't have a way to get more money. So nothing changes. You're just out of money, as opposed to a company that is generating revenue or is even profitable. It's like, okay, if nothing changes, again, modulo like customers leaving or whatever, but like steady state, you're good. Huge difference in you know, going back to like these stereotypes of not making much money, working really long hours, depending on what type of, you know, what stage your company's at, that's where it kind of comes. Because like, again, it's sort of like, if you think about it, you're not making revenue yet. How much money do you offer your employees? That is a strategic decision based on the founders. They can either be like, oh, we really need to like pinch pennies, so we're all gonna take less money for more equity. So like hopefully a bigger payout later when the company is worth more money. or other startups, even very early stage, or like, we need to compete with these big companies. They have some really great engineers who just aren't going to take a low salary. So we're going to offer a lot of money, and different strategy could be, let's hire fewer engineers, but like really be specific about this is the skill set we need and we're willing to pay top dollar for it. That's a very real and very popular strategy as well. So it's not even necessarily that like, oh, earlier stage startup, you're going to be paid less. It really just depends on the startup stage. Again, does help. Like if you're making money, then probably like you have room to negotiate, et cetera, et cetera. You do also in early stage, but again, like there's literally a finite pot of money. And then in terms of working really long hours, again, also depends on the startup. I think it also depends on your role. It's really, again, about stability. One of the biggest differences between like Google and Glitch in terms of just the stability is like Google has existed for over 2 decades. And so not only that, it's like they have so many engineers, so many layers in place, like systems in place to ensure that Google doesn't go down. Like very famously, if you don't know much about like systems, or you don't know, maybe you don't know much about programming, you might think, oh, Google engineers must be just really smart and never make mistakes. Wrong. they're very smart, right? But like the thing is, Google designs systems so that they are hard to break, so that like you can't accidentally like make a command and then take down Google. Like they build layers and layers and layers and layers and layers of protection to try to prevent that from happening in a way that's measurable. You can probabilistically determine here is the error rate into a very small amount. It takes a lot of effort. Again, there are pros and cons to that as well. So startup, none of that. you know how I said, like, you know, you can't drop your laptop. Oops, database gone. Oh, you could do that in a startup. A lot of startups, I won't give specifics, but like, there are some practices that, oh my God, I hope no one runs that command because our entire database would go down. Like things like that. It's just like you don't have the time or the people to like invest in all these systems. So again, that's also, neither of these things are necessarily purely better or worse than the other. So again, when you think of Google, layer, 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 for better and worse, harder to change. Harder to change means harder to break. Harder to change means slower to innovate. Startup, fewer layers, easy to break. But if you have a lot of mistakes, easy to tear down. Like you can start over, you can move faster. So I think that's sort of like the tension between big company established. Think about even code, like the code itself is like more stable, but it means less innovation. It means more layers. It means probably you're working on a smaller piece of it. Startup, less stable, but bigger opportunities for impact. Even in terms of code, it's often much easier and much more feasible to rewrite a system at a startup than it would be at a large company.
It sounds like if you're working in a startup, like you maybe have more leadership, more control over a lot of the things that you're building, even as someone who's maybe new to the industry, new to the company, versus at bigger companies, like there's a lot, like you were saying, there's a lot of layers to get through, a lot of different maybe politics and rules to get through and then eventually reach those leadership positions. It's really like what you're looking for and what kind of experience you want to learn from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in terms of like, you know, why is it still worth trying? I really recommend people, if they are in a financial and mental and like just life state where they can handle the instability of a startup, they should try it. Because one, I think they're very different experiences. I think it's hard to tell if you like one or the other or like both, but you know, for different reasons without having tried both. And then especially for underrepresented people, again, it can go in either direction, but it can also be a chance to realize you're capable of a lot more than what maybe your level is, or what maybe like in a big company, underrepresented people, women are famously underleveled because of, yeah, you have these systems that are hard to change. You have promo processes that are very like rigid, and all these biases and all these things just like do not work out well for folks who are underrepresented. And there's not really, at least I don't know of any of these big companies that are doing things to try to combat that in a meaningful way. I do think it's a hard problem, but I also don't see effort. I don't see much effort versus at a startup where everything's fluid. Again, it can go one direction or the other. Fluid could mean no HR. Fluid can mean an even worse experience because there's truly no guardrails. But in the positive direction, it can also mean like there are big opportunities here. There's so much work to do. Like you could become VP of engineering, or you can become CTO or CEO even. Like there are all these roles where you don't have to go through necessarily the hoops where you would have to in a bigger company.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And since you mentioned it, I also just like have to ask you, because I've never talked to a former VP of engineering. So what are some responsibilities of a VP of engineering? Like what did you actually do in that role?
Yeah. Okay. So like, again, of course, my answer, of course, is going to be, it depends. And of course, my answer is also going to be like, I too Googled this once. So like, there's actually a fantastic book that, if I could recommend one book for people trying to figure out like navigate a career in tech, it is The Manager's Path by Camille Fournier. Camille is very much an engineer, very technical. And she has written this guide as almost technical documentation. What I really appreciated about this is like, okay, if you actually are just trying to figure out what does a manager mean? What is a tech lead? What are these definitions? Defining it in terms of like, you know, what's the role? What's the expectations? Why might you do it? It's a technical guidebook to one's engineering career path. Based on that, right? Yeah. Why part of this is helpful is because otherwise you have to like rely on like a whisper network and your experiences. And like, how often are you VP of engineering? Like, even if you're very successful in your career, not that often. So it's like, it can be hard to come up with a common definition without a reference. So the definition of VP of engineering depends. If there's a CTO, then usually there's a distinction between CTO and VP of engineering. CTO being an exec C-suite position, more strategic, more business. And VP of engineering is about getting things done. So it's sort of like, again, if you think of roles as sort of like growing and growing in scope, maybe your first leadership position is technical lead. And you know, what does a tech lead do? Honestly, at the end of the day, you're the primary person responsible for the execution of the project. So if you think of that, going all the way to VP of engineering being sort of the end of the road in terms of like our highest ranking manager, I suppose, eng manager, eng lead, they're the person who ensures the execution and successful delivery of everything in engineering. So that means people management. That also means project management. It means like, how are your unit tests doing? At the end of the day, get it done. And so because it's a role that's defined like that, it can mean a lot of different responsibilities. Again, depending on the company, it could be the case that you have a CTO, but no VPE. At Glitch, they had a VPE, but no CTO. Naturally, you end up taking sort of both roles. So anyway, some examples then of like, what do you do as a, you know, VP of engineering? There's a lot of strategic discussions about like, okay, let's say that someone in product, whether that's your CEO, whether that's product manager, has like a vision, like a, here's where the company and product needs to be in the next 6 months or something. So you get a prompt sort of like that. And then you work with, it's very collaborative. You work with the people necessary, like a lot of your reports, your teams, to like sort of come up with a strategic engineering plan for that of like, okay, how do we get there? Is it feasible? Is it possible? What do we need? That's one core responsibility is sort of like, okay, take idea from usually someone who is not, doesn't have like engineer in their title, something maybe a little more loosely defined, more business related, and then coming up with like sort of a cohesive execution plan with all of the people. Like, again, not necessarily even me being the one to handwrite it, but to like get my like directors and eng managers to like come up with a plan together. Other things are things like culture, like what does it mean to get promoted? Also just things like really specific examples are on call, like our, you know, pager duty processes weren't really working out for us. So like figuring out how are we going to change on call? Are we going to offer incentives for it, monetary incentives? Like, those sorts of things are like big picture, holistic engineering decisions, none of which are would ever be like me, Victoria, in a vacuum, like thinking about things and then like dictating them. But rather it's like, it's my responsibility to like corral, like, and get to an answer on these things in a given time frame.
So kind of like collaborating with all the people that are in engineering, making those decisions, but really making it a decision that everyone agrees upon, and everything just kind of like is like your responsibility, almost like you were talking about with like a tech lead, like it's their responsibility to bring a project to fruition. It's your responsibility exactly. to kind of bring all the projects to the end.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, there are times when you don't all agree, and it is your responsibility as, you know, VP of engineering to take responsibility then for the decision. So there are also times where it's like, okay, we tried our best to come to agreement. You know, we're at 80% agreement, or even just a hard override just based on like, no, I think you gotta do this. Again, you kind of want to like, you hope for that to be like more of a last resort than a thing you do regularly. But just like being a tech lead, you know, sometimes you can't always decide things by committee. Sometimes you're like, well, ship it. Yeah. You have to go with this, you know, like that sort of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. I want to kind of switch gears again into an initiative that you're starting, this new project called Everybody Study Club. So I would like if you could tell me, like, what is Everybody Study Club and what inspired you to start it?
It's very much in its infancy right now. Right now, it's like more of a half-baked idea than like an entity per se. So I have had, you know, this career where I've been really passionate about how to teach programming. And, you know, in my career path, I've been trying to figure out like, okay, what's the right relationship with me and teaching, me and education? And, you know, at one point I was a lecturer, I was a full-time teacher. And what was sort of surprising to me was that was actually not a good fit for me personally, even though I love, like, I have nothing but like the most greatest admiration for the lecturers at Stanford. They, like, they're the most wonderful, like thoughtful, great coworkers you could ask for. Students are great, but just personally wasn't a great fit for me, but I care so much about teaching. And so it's like, okay, if I can't literally, if it's not going to work in this, like, again, this equation of like fulfillment and what's good for me, and like, how can I offer this like education of some way that's sustainable for me? Again, like for me, being in an academic environment was very stressful. Like school was, even if I was good at school, it was extremely stressful for me. And so I think about that, like, okay, so for me, school was very stressful. Education, however, is very important and it's critical and it's something I'm passionate about. Can we play around with this idea of teaching and see how we can experiment with are there different formats where of like either self-directed learning or community learning where we can get the benefits of learning without necessarily being in an academic environment or in a class per se. Not that there is not value in that, not that this is replacing it. It's just, let's try experimenting with it. So that's the vague mission statement of the Everybody Study Club. You know, I want to experiment with the format of online learning, what that even means, what that could look like. I think my target audience is folks who have wanted to study something by themselves and like just don't do it, or like you're like, I have this idea for a side project, haven't made it, you know, the actually doing it is really hard. That's sort of like a place I want to play with. So what inspired me is actually, of course, COVID affected everyone, right? Like I found myself with a lot of free time once the pandemic hit. And again, for me personally, for my own mental health, I needed to find a way to have some sort of positive thing in my life where I could feel like I was growing or something. Otherwise I would, you know, I was already feeling like I was getting depressed. So I'm half Korean. So a lifelong goal of mine has been to be fluent in Korean, which I had just thought was impossible, actually. Like I thought, oh, well, I should have spoke Korean when I was 10. Too late. I'm not 10 anymore. I'm like, but then I looked into it. Can adults and someone over 30 be fluent in the language? And it seems so silly, but it's like, the answer is yes. And you just need to put time into it. So I ended up actually for the first time in my life with the pandemic, finding a way that I could self-study successfully. And it's been a really wonderful thing in my life. It's something also that like took a lot of effort. Like I think if had I not had so much free time, I wouldn't have figured out what are the mechanisms that work for me. And so I would love to sort of take some of the learnings from that and see like, okay, are there ways that, you know, we could model this that also works for other people where you have this like mechanism for like learning, whether it's Korean or programming or anything you want, not necessarily in a school environment.
The Everybody Study Club, is it kind of like just having this accountability group where you can hold each other accountable to studying and learning something new?
Probably the format it's going to take is, yeah, like a study hall situation. We're like setting up a Discord server and the idea would be like, okay, we're going to have like some like quote unquote TAs who are like, okay, we're dedicated folks. You can ask us questions about things and we're going to just hang out. And then you can also hang out in the Discord server if you want. And we'll have like a dedicated time that you can just come hang out, work on something. Tentative plan is to like stream K-pop, piano music, and like the like voice channel. It's an experiment. I think we're going to do something like that. A short run of like, let's try that for 5 weeks. Again, do a retrospective. Was that fun? Was that awkward? Like, did anyone show up? And then, yeah, like just sort of like iterating on that too, like whether it's successful or not, trying different versions of that.
Cool. And so if people are interested, it's not just learning programming, right? It's like learning anything you want.
Okay. Anything you want. Yeah.
Cool. And then, so how can people sign up to be a part of this?
Okay, so if you go to everybodystudy.club and then there's a link to an interest form. Again, it has some questions about programming, but if you're not a programmer at all, that's totally fine. Just fill that out. And then sometime in March, I'm going to be sending a proper like, okay, here's the thing. Like, here's what this is and how to sign up for real. So this is just like early interest form, sign up for that. And then expect an email sometime in March that gives more details what it's about.
Sounds good. I'll put a link to that in the show notes for this episode so people can just click on that and sign up.
Yay!
Awesome. Okay, so I wanted to wrap up, which I have some more like fun questions, which basically means they're not related to anything we just talked about.
Great.
except for the first one. The first one is, what career advice would you give your younger self after graduating college?
So I'm going to give an answer that, again, makes me feel like old, but it's have more fun, which I remember being college age and like people are like, oh, you should have more fun. And I'm like, what are you talking about? This is me. You know nothing about my life. But no, I definitely, with more perspective, as many before me have realized, there is such a thing as too much fun in college. But especially near the end, I feel like I wish I had loosened up a bit. And then like, again, immediately after college, I also think is a wonderful opportunity to just, again, explore more. An analogy I use is it's kind of like if you play video games, it's like a long tutorial mode. tutorial mode was like through college and you graduate and now you're open world. Like, oh gosh, it can be really scary. There's no like objectives, like open world now. But I actually think what I was doing is like, I gotta find the quest, you know, like, and I wish I had just chilled. open world. Okay, great. I can like explore. It's a great time to travel. You don't have as much stuff or attachments or ties or responsibilities. I wish I had just, you know, traveled, had fun, made more friends. Like, I think that's like the great thing to do with your time right after graduation.
Yeah, I was actually talking to a college student recently about how, like, when you're about to graduate, you feel like you have to find your dream job right out of college. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no. Like, if you're finding a dream job right out of college, like, there's a problem. That should not be your dream job. Like, you have so much time and you don't realize.
Yeah, you're going to have the crisis. Yeah, just like I did. Like, just like, too much time. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so what is your favorite hobby?
Lately, I've been really into phone games. Again, I'm not really a gamer. I'm like the type, like Animal Crossing is like a great game for me, right? Like that's my level. So I really like problematic, very addicting phone games where it's just like, oh, click these things a lot and then wait for ads. For some reason, if it's cute, like if the art is really cute, I'm like, well, guess I'm playing this game forever. So Yeah, so that's, gosh, I've chosen that as my favorite hobby, but like that is at least a hobby that I'm very into right now, other than of course like things like teaching and stuff.
No, that's amazing. I love it so much. What is something absurd that you love doing?
So I've been really into highlighters lately. Okay, so it's part of my studying journey. There's a whole study YouTube community that I didn't know about. I'm like at least a decade older than like the target demographic. Mostly high schoolers, some college students. But like it's these awesome like students who have just made everything super aesthetic about like their entire school life. So like their notes are gorgeous and all their stationery is gorgeous. And there's even just like, you can have normal highlighters, but there are like beautiful pastel Japanese highlighters that you can get. And there's not just one type of Japanese highlighter, you can get entire family, entire universe of highlighters. And there's something just so satisfying of like, I'm writing my notes and I have like beautiful pastel light purple highlighter. So the absurdity is like, I love highlighting things. If it's a good color, very satisfying.
I love that. This is just like my favorite question to ask people because it's always just pretty random, but it's always something that people are just like super passionate about. Right. Something that people don't think about. Like someone recently has a ballpoint pen collection. I was like, whoa, like I've just never thought of that. And we're still in like the stationary.
Yeah, I get it. I get ballpoint pens because I have highlighters. Okay, well, you got to highlight over something, but your pen sort of, you know, smudges when you highlight over. Well, there is a special type of pen that does not smudge if you highlight. Like, it just, you can get through an entire rabbit hole that I have very much down right now.
That's for a different podcast episode.
Yes, exactly.
So my final question is what I always ask every guest, because Blossoming Technologist is all about becoming a technologist and also all these skills that people are always learning, whether it's in your career or just in your regular life. I would love to hear, what is one skill that you're currently working on?
Totally unrelated to tech is Korean. I've been improving my Korean skills because I found out recently you can still become fluent even if you're over the age of 30 and not living in their target language countries. So with great success, like I've gotten a lot better. So that's been fun and inspiring. And then like more career-ish related is I am working on setting boundaries and like really trying to stop myself from trying to solve every problem. A lot of times, if you are solving every problem, then you're, again, not really being intentional with, okay, what are the problems I want to solve? And what do I like to solve? And like, what am I here for? So that's something I've been working on, is trying to like focus on myself, being really intentional about my career and the things that I do, and not just running to solve a problem because it's there to be solved, and more about like, okay, what is the best problem to solve, both in terms of like outcome, but also what I actually want to do and feel fulfilled by.
That's amazing. I feel like it's so important to have that realization and figure out that, yes, I need to understand the problems that matter to me and how I want to solve those.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being on Blossoming Technologist. It was so fun talking to you. You probably tell by all our giggling.
This was a blast.
Today's episode was a whirlwind of information, and I feel so inspired by Victoria and her enthusiasm for software engineering and education. My biggest takeaway was thinking about needing people who don't want to sit behind a desk all day in software engineering, because they are the ones who turn into principal engineers, the CTOs, and the other managers. Software is more than just the technology. If you'd like to reach out to Victoria, her social media is linked in the show notes. If this resonated, I would love to hear from you on what you liked about it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time, where we'll continue blossoming together.